Welcome to this Catholic Theological Union podcast, featuring conversations we must have in religious life today. This podcast was sponsored by the Center for the Study of Consecrated Life and was recorded at CTU on September 23rd, 2015. CTU's first event on this topic took place on April 14th, 2015. This follow-up discussion features six panelists who present their work based on the first round of conversations. The event is emceed by Sister Maria Simperman, RSCJ, Associate Professor of Theological Ethics at CTU, and the Director of the Center for the Study of Consecrated Life.
My name is Sister Maria Simperman. I'm a religious of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and I am Associate Professor of Theological Ethics here, and also have the privilege of being the first director for our new Center for the Study of Consecrated Life here at CTU. We're here because, as we all know, consecrated life is in the midst of massive and significant transformation, not only in the United States, but definitely in the United States. And you and we are here because there are conversations we must have about consecrated life today in order to do our part in the transformation, the revitalization of religious life and consecrated life today. We have here this evening five topics that have evolved since the first conversation was had over dinner in April of this past year. So our effort here at the center is to take on issues in contemporary consecrated life and to bring our theological and experiential lens to it, to bring those two and to say, how might we be of use, of service to the life today? And so tonight we look at five areas: poverty, community, interculturality, environment, and paschal mystery. These are not the only conversations we need to have, but they're a start and they are important. Each topic today will have 15 minutes for our presenters to engage with us. So four of the topics have one presenter, and one topic, the environment, we thought it was too big for one person, will have two persons engaging, and they actually were the people who started the Green Seminary here at CTU. We will begin with vows and the ecological crisis with Sister Mary Froelich, RSCJ, Associate Professor of Spirituality.
Today, the Pope, one of the things that he said was, when it comes to the care of our common home, the earth, we are living at a critical moment of history. So the question is, what does that mean for us as religious? And I'm going to start with just three vignettes that I think might say something about that. The first one's just a little story. A man sought out a wise rabbi and said, "Why can't the people find God?" The rabbi replied, "Because they don't think to look so low." Second vignette. At our house, one of the kitchen tasks is to feed the worms. We take the scraps and the leftovers out to the compost bin, where the worms have a feast. We feed the worms because the worms feed us. The worms and many other tiny, unknown, unheralded creatures literally make the soil without which we could not eat. And the third vignette is actually a quote from Laudato Si. We're speaking of an attitude of the heart, one which approaches life with serene attentiveness, which is capable of being fully present to someone without thinking of what comes next, which accepts each moment as a gift from God to be lived to the full. Jesus taught us this attitude when he invited us to contemplate the lilies of the field and the birds of the air. He was completely present to everyone and to everything. And in this way, he showed us the way to overcome that unhealthy anxiety which makes us superficial, aggressive, and compulsive consumers. So those are three kind of random vignettes in a way, but I think they actually point to a program, perhaps, for religious life at this critical moment of history. First, to practice looking down to find God. Second, to feed the worms. Or, maybe if you don't do that literally, the point of that is that we need to take care of those humble creatures who actually are taking care of us. We truly are all interconnected. And so caring for the worms and for all the other creatures is actually a form even of taking care of ourselves. And thirdly, to contemplate the lilies of the field and the birds of the air and let them be our teachers in the new way of being that is needed at this critical moment in history. And since I was supposed to address the vows, I'm only going to just refer to the one vow, the religious poverty. In the past, poverty was often associated with things like self-denial, detachment, and austerity. And obviously, those do have something to do with poverty. But I would suggest that today, religious poverty, perhaps the most important aspect of poverty is to live in a constant search to discover how to be kin, to be community members with all the creatures of God, to discover how we do share life, that interconnection that is ours, and then to live that, to live it as a community experience. A religious life, community, I think, is a core dimension of religious life. And we must learn how to live that in a broader way than we have lived it in the past. And of course, also as religious, we know that that is not a simple and easy thing. If that living community is often very difficult and very demanding. And likewise, as we learn to live as community with all the creatures of God. Maybe Jesus said it best in the Beatitude, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." One way of paraphrasing that, and maybe, I don't know if the biblical scholars would go with this, but my reflection on it is, blessed are those who live in community with all the humblest creatures of the earth, for they shall be the beloved children of the Creator. So I think at this critical moment of history, in regard to the care of our common home, our challenge is, how can we live as kin to all creatures of the earth so the earth community can thrive? And how can we share that vision with all the people among whom we minister?
We continue living the vows in response to the ecological crisis with Franciscan Sister Dawn Noether, Professor of Catholic Theological Ethics.
In Laudato Si, care for our common home, Pope Francis calls us and the world to ecological conversion and to a lifestyle governed by the principles of integral ecology. He reminds us that the human life is grounded in three fundamental and closely intertwined relationships with God, with our neighbor, and the earth itself. He says that in number 66 of Laudato Si. Our ecological conversion requires that we take on a distinctive way of looking at all things, so he says in number 111. For us, committed to consecrated life, I think a first step toward this end must be a renewed commitment to the contemplation of our Trinitarian, radically related, and God who created a world that is related at its very core. Thus, I offer this reflection based on St. Bonaventure's creation theology as a starting point.
You will now be listening to the song "Trinity of Love" by Kathy Tissold Nelson.
We will now hear about interculturality and religious life from SVD Father Roger Schroeder, Professor of Intercultural Studies and Ministry.
Of the process of cultural interaction on both the personal and social level. The mutuality of that. Going beyond multicultural, which is tolerance. Multicultural is the fact that we are of different cultures in the same room. Okay, that's a fact that's here. And tolerance, hopefully, at least that, huh? But we're going beyond that, of course. Two, cross-cultural, which can be understood as going one direction to another culture. To the understanding of intercultural, mutual dimensional exchange and enrichment from Van Thong Nguyen in his own writing. Why do we do this? For the sake of God's kingdom, for the reign of God. There are business people that want to do this for the sake of achieving a business. But for us, for the sake of God's reign. That's why we are concerned about this. And it's both ad intra, within our religious community, consecrated life, and ad extra, the communities in which we live and serve. So the culture is both ways, both ad intra and ad extra. I know that many of us in different communities are in different places with this question of interculturality. For some, we've been living this for a long time. For others, this is something of a new phenomenon that's occurring. Either way, I hope you can sort of take the question and apply it to your own situation. In Evangelii Nuntiandi, Pope Paul VI, the first means of evangelization is the witness of an authentically Christian life. Authentically Christian life, to me, includes also mutual relationships between people of different cultures. Now, when I use the term culture, I want to take that in a broad sense. Culture can mean actual ethnic background, nationality, gender, generations, in many different ways, that mutually enriching relationships. So how we live makes a difference in what we do. This is the connection between the ad intra and the ad extra. Modern women and men listen more willingly to witnesses than to teachers. They do listen to teachers, it's because they are witnesses. Every time I say this, I think of myself as a teacher. What does that mean, We got to live what we teach. So as religious community members or members in consecrated life, how do we live what we say? How can we be instruments of interculturality in the world if we don't do it amongst ourselves? We must have that together. So just a couple things that I picked up along the way. Experience is not enough. Now, we have plenty of experience, both ad intra and ad extra, and that's good. We have that experience. We're not living in a bubble. However, experience is a good teacher, but we have to learn from that experience, which requires reflection and action based on experience. And that can be on a personal level, a communal level, or in terms of an ecclesial level. A couple images here of some multicultural communities, men's and women's communities. So experience is good, but we have to reflect upon that experience. Tolerance is a trap. There's our mouse trap there, Okay. It's a trap if we stay at tolerance. Jerry Arbuckle talks about three different stages when you talk about interculturality. The first is where you enjoy the differences. We're fascinated by different foods and different things that we do in that regards. The second phase is where we're not so happy with the differences. They're a little irritating. We get to surface, especially those differences that are deeper than what we're wearing. Sometimes the temptation is, when we get to that stage, is to go back to the first. Oh, let's have a nice meal together and everybody cook your own food and let's get together. Nothing against food. However, it can be a temptation to do that rather than taking the third step, where we actually engage our differences. And how do we do that in that way? And that's why I say we have to move beyond tolerance to really mutual and cultural living. This is challenging. We all know that. We need theory plus skills. We need to know something about social and cultural context, and they are very complex. One of the things that I've learned since April is recently I had a conversation with, I have his name there, Luca Pandolfi. He's Italian. He teaches at the Urbaniana University in Rome. He's an anthropologist. He's worked in Chile. Anyways, when I was talking to him about interculturality, and he was reading some of the things that I had written, and he was very insistent to say, but you know, culture is very complex. Huh? And sometimes in theology, we sort of skip over all of that, huh? But to realize it's very complex situations. Social change, I mean, so many things, difference in gender, I mean, all these things, huh? So when we talk about this, we need to know that it's complex. Complex doesn't mean impossible. But we need to know it's more complex. If we simplify it too much, we're not doing justice to the other or to ourselves. Just to give an example, for when I did some work some years ago with the SS, with a contemplative community, a cloistered community of Pink Sisters in St. Louis, and they were having, in their community, they had half of their members were of Asian origins, birth, and the others were half were born in the U.S. And they were having conflicts. This is in a cloistered community now. They were having conflicts, so they asked if I asked also a Vietnamese sister to come with me, so it would be a man, woman together, and a white and an Asian person coming together. And when we got together with them, this is after conversations to understand what their questions were, we began to present some of the theory about social-centric societies, those who put emphasis on the well-being of the group, and individual-centric societies that put emphasis on the well-being of the individual. Now, each system in itself is all, you know, is good and bad, all, and it can go one way or another. But as we sort of presented that, I remember seeing the superior of the community sitting in the back of the room, and her jaw just went. As we started talking, then she began to understand what were some of these dynamics that were going on, huh? To understand it. Because the two sides are two sides. The two groups were looking at it in very different ways because of different values. And the behavior came out of that, huh? So understanding some theory can be helpful for understanding why we do what we do. It gives us a framework in that regards. Huh? The social sciences have been doing a lot in interculturality. One of the areas is in decoloniality or post-colonialism. And again, in a conversation I had recently with Adriana Milmanda, she is one of our graduates from Argentina, and conversations via email. And for her, as she was reflecting on this from her Latin American context, saying how important decoloniality is so much a part of the dynamics they're dealing with in their situation in Latin America. Huh? So you need to understand that, to understand what's happening in these relationships. Huh? The second is that of globalization, obviously a very big topic, but how is that impacting? Huh? And the social sciences are saying we need interculturality to get beyond the evils of globalization. The third is the area of ethnocentrism to ethno-relativism. Milton Bennett is the one who has done a lot of work in that area, and he talks about five different stages. How do you go from ethnocentrism to ethno-relativism? Okay. Now, ethno-relativism as a term I have a little problems with, but you can put another word in there like interculturality or something like that. I've been using this with some of the SVDs and SSBS sisters I've been working with on an international level to sort of see where do we stand on that scale. So again, we're sort of using sociological tools to sort of understand where we're at. Huh? Not everybody can do that, but some of us need to be more aware of where we and our communities are at in this process. Huh? Now in terms of interculturality and formation. And there is a, if you look on the last page of the back of the second page of the handout, there's a bit of a graph there that was done by John Kirby, an anthropologist and SVD. And there we talked about different types of formation. The first is that of the exit learning, which is what some of us call initial formation, learning to leave, and talking about various things under that that's involved. How do people learn to leave their own culture? It begins by really understanding yourself, but how do you move? The next is entry learning. I got a misspelling there, leaving to learn. So in other words, when you go to a new place, how do you learn there, huh? And what needs to be done, both by the receiving community and as you go into that situation, huh? Okay. The third area is re-entry. That is when people who have been outside of their culture come back home again. Okay. So these are all three important moments, huh? And how is that? How do we deal with that in initial formation, ongoing formation, and the reentry? Huh? These are big topics. Huh? I'm just sort of laying this out here. Various aspects: knowledge, skill, emotion, behavior. That's all in that chart. That's on that final, the second back of the second page. It applies both ad intra within our communities and ad extra outside in our work. In terms of spirituality for interculturality, there is the second conversion. I think I might have talked about this in April. This is what Peter went through with Cornelius to get over his own ethnocentrism, to realize that God was calling other peoples. Huh? So it applies to all of us. This is our motivation. Why do we do this? We have to go, and this is a lifelong process, huh? To get beyond our own ethnocentrism, whatever form that takes. So to develop a understanding of the spirituality of interculturality, these are some ideas that I've been circulating and working with some other people. The idea of the second conversion. Often we then go to the mission statements of the congregation. Also the community charism, historical roots, new context today, and what are the theological foundations? That area of the theological foundations is another area that I'm very interested in doing. I talked to Kirsten Kim. She is someone working in UK, also is very interested in this. So how do we continue to develop that? Huh? So one of the projects that I'm going to be involved in January when I go to Rome, I'll be getting together with a men and women developing a retreat on interculturality. Yeah? So we're going to be working together. It's a team, international team, coming. I'll be working with them as well, along as with others. We've been talking about this for a couple years, but now we're trying to get to the point of actually developing a retreat in this way. Huh? Okay. My last slide. So these are some new books that have come out since April. Okay. So first of all, this is the book by Tony Gittins, who used to teach here at CTU. Living Mission Interculturally, Faith, Culture, and Renewal Praxis. Both Marie and I have little endorsements in this book here. This is an excellent resource. It just has come out now. I just got my copy yesterday, huh? So it's fresh off the press. I think it's an excellent resource. Huh? The other one there is by Fernando Ortiz and Gerard McClone. Some of you would know him from his other work or their other work. To Be One in Christ, Intercultural Formation and Ministry. This is very much based on a U.S. context. Formation here in the U.S., and people coming from other countries. There's some beautiful chapters in there for an African coming to work and minister here in the States, somebody from Hispanic coming here. So some very interesting materials. The third one is a work that's been done by two SVDs in my community, Lazar Stanislaus from India and Martin Ufing from Germany. This is a two-volume work, and some people from CTU are also have chapters in that book. I haven't seen that book yet. I heard it's out, but I haven't seen it yet. But again, in other words, there's a lot being done just since April, huh, that I'm aware of in English at least. Huh? So I think that what we see here is there's a lot of materials, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this area, and as I said at the beginning, sort of take this and situate it within your own context.
Now, I, Maria Simperman, Religious of the Sacred Heart of Jesus and Associate Professor of Theological Ethics, will speak to community, a life to be lived, awakening hope, courage, and mercy. Community, a life to be lived, awakening hope, courage, and mercy. It also awakens humility in me because it's very humbling to speak on community when the community you live with is here in this very room. And they're the ones that remember when you haven't put your cup away properly or if you happen to have forgotten to take the lint out of the dryer. But it's also the community that I pray with and that I share with and that know me. And that's the blessing of both. And so, community. I'd like to look at three areas of conversation, and actually for me, they feel like conversion. Mission and the role of community in mission, charism and community, and look at Emmaus as an image for community. Mission, the role of community in mission. We know pretty much now, when we talk about mission, the subject of mission is God. It's not us, it's God. But I think sometimes, or I wonder, if we mistake mission and ministry. We put those two together. Mission is ministry. And that's right, and we have community and prayer, and that goes along with it. But actually, the subject of mission is God. And in consecrated life, in religious life, it includes community, ministry, and prayer, all three of them. So unless you do a unicycle and can just balance life with one, it's not going to work. Think of this as a three-legged stool. Mission is a circle, and the three legs are needed. And the tension is they're not equal. They're equal in value, but it's not 888 in a given day, right? At least not for me. But they all need to be looked at. And actually, all of these areas are in need of revitalization, all of them. And we're hearing that from everywhere. I'd like to use, though, the example of ministry as a way to look at how we might then look at community. And part of this is that everything is shifting because the context is that life is shifting. The church is shifting. The United States is shifting. The ground underneath us in so many ways is, and that is part of the gift we have to live with as well. Okay? So with ministry, the reality is that where we are and where we are needed is also shifting. And allow me to use an example. Some years ago, I worked with a congregation, and they were looking at their charism, which was reconciliation. And they were doing amazing work. And they had been around over 100 years, and they had been longstanding in places. And one of the things they were realizing, though, when they went deeply into their sources of reconciliation, both scripture and their constitutions, was, you know, the world is asking something, and are we just doing what we've been doing because we've been doing it? But something else is calling forth. The Spirit is inviting something. And this is where it takes courage to listen, to be wholehearted and saying, God, I want to do what you're calling. And also to be merciful, a willingness to enter into the chaos of others' lives, including your own when you make shifts. But they were also saying, where are we needed to offer hope today? We offer hope by our being also in particular places. And our presence is hope. Even though hope in espero is both hope and waiting. I learned that this summer. I thought, no, I don't want to wait. I want hope. I had much to learn. So if we're looking at the world around us with our charisms and calls, this week we have a pope who's saying, I'm calling you into so many places. And we've only heard a few things so far. But we know where he's going with so many areas. And this same week in New York, we have the UN meeting on sustainable development. So the goals that will replace the Millennium Development Goals will be coming out this month. So what are the signs in the times? What are they inviting us? All of these are part of that. And so in light of all of this, I just wonder, in light of our charism, what is the world longing for? And in light of our charism, what does our church need? And what might our charism offer then for where we are to be? This is where often we stop. And actually, we've really pushed hard and done well to even be asking these questions. But friends, there's another question. It's asking that same thing in light of community. And really, community has particular meaning in particular times. It's framed and reframed with the essentials intact. But it's reframed, just like our vows also. Have the scripture, have our constitutions and places in our traditions. But they continue to get nuanced by where we are and what the needs are. So I wonder what time it is for that. If we look at community and charism, we're realizing it's about public witness. Our community life, intra and extra, is a public witness. This past Saturday, we had some of our SVD brothers make final vows, final professional vows. That's a public event. So our community life, as much as our ministry and prayer, is also a public witness. So then that asks the question, what does the world in terms of community need, and what does the church need from us in terms of community? Actually, what might community, through our charism, offer the church and world? I wonder if we've been asking that, and I wonder if that reframes us, too, to say, even what's needed for that? We know that charism is a gift of the Spirit given to a person and persons in a group for the church and for the world. It's not for us, but every way is manifested by us and through us. And that's one of the ways the Spirit works. So what does our charism offer for how we are to live and love today, which also responds to the needs of the times? We hear from Pope Francis, the thing the church needs most today is the ability to heal wounds and to warm the hearts of the faithful. It needs nearness and proximity. Heal the wounds. And you have to start from the ground up, he says. Laudato Si says, as Christians, we're called to accept the world as a sacrament of communion, as a way of sharing with God and our neighbors on a global scale. So I just wonder, and when you wonder, you're asking for something a little more creative. How shall community witness to unmet needs in the world and church today? I offer an example from the Focolare movement and Maria Voce, who is their president. Their charism is unity. And Maria says that in the Focolare movement, the encounter between cultures and religions is an ongoing and faithful experience not confined to tolerance or the mere recognition of diversity. Think of what Roger was saying. And she says, it is clear that our times do not require half measures. If violent extremism exists, while accepting the need to defend oneself, and especially those who are weak and persecuted, our response must be similarly radical, but one that is structurally different, by which I mean extremism in dialogue. It's a dialogue which requires the highest level of engagement, which is risky, demanding, challenging, and which aims to sever the roots of incomprehension, fear, and bitterness. And for the record, all the reading I keep doing is saying the people coming in want that kind of life. I want to give it all away if I'm coming into consecrated life. So have a way of living that asks all of me. So then the question is, how shall community, through our charism, witness to unmet needs in the world and church today? If we did, I wonder, what would Chicago look like after a weekend as violent as we've had? What would it feel like? Because what you're asking here is, how may my charism somehow offer what the world needs through community as well? And we hear Francis uses church, but I've changed this around to put in community. Let community always be a place of mercy and hope, where everyone is welcomed, loved, and forgiven. We must model this and widen this, I say, according to our charism. So when you think of your charism, what way of living community might be invited at this time with the world's needs? I have to ask that as a religious of the sacred heart. With a charism that talks about discovering and revealing God's love, to know myself as loved and beloved, and to know the other that way too, and to open that, invite that space in the other for God, and to go to the wounded heart of humanity and the earth. And we say we long to be women who create communion. What does that say about community and what's being invited of us today? I'm not the only one asking this. Jesuit Father General Adolfo Nicolas talked about this in his interview before he was elected General Superior. He says, I have a feeling, still imprecise and difficult to define, that there's something important in our religious life that needs attention and is not getting it. We have certainly been diligent in addressing all of our problems wherever we've seen them, but there's an uneasiness. And he says, is it enough that we're happy with our life and improving our service and ministry? How come we have so much admiration and so little following? And then he asks this. Here's my hope, he says. I want a dynamic and open reflection on our religious life that might begin a process of recreation of the society for our times, but also and mostly in the quality of our personal and community witness to the church and world. So what is that inviting? It's a call to shore up our foundations, to go to them again and say, what is being asked for this time? Scripture, our constitutions, but also to expand our horizons. Community necessarily widens us even as it shapes our identity. Right? The image here is of stretching. Now you probably need to stretch, but there's a stretching needed. Well, there's also an elasticity being asked of us right now. There's also something growing. I love this image. Some say it's Elizabeth and Mary. They're both being stretched with new life. They're both pregnant with possibility in body and spirit to trust and to give in love. So I would say that what we're getting at today really are the gifts, graces, and indicators for today, which I'm looking for a better word and you might have it, but the inters. What is our reality right now in community? We're far more intergenerational, though not evenly so. That's an invitation. We're intercultural, but actually we're far more international. We've seen how difficult it is to grow in interculturality and that it's a process. We're growing as a family. We see that there, you know, it's the Franciscan family, the Mercy family. It gets bigger, the SVD family. We're also realizing we need to be more ecclesial, inter-ecclesial, and we're working at dialogue. It's time to embrace these. They are what we offer if we are but willing to encounter one another in it. And there's the challenge. But I have this image of prayer here because that is, and I hope sometime, LCWR and the other stories will come forth about what it took to do inter-ecclesial in this way and how much it was very much a contemplative process for the women and the men with us. And I imagine the same has been with so many of the crises, also with men and women. So what this invites right now are the gifts and calls of intergenerational dialogue. I'm only taking one and I'm working on all of them. But my example for you is with Tere Maya, an Incarnate Word sister, and Sandra Schneider's IHM. Each gave a talk about a year ago, or wrote a paper and a talk. And one, Sandra talked about, don't forget the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We have so much more to still offer. Okay, and please let us do it. And the other one said, but please mentor us, and please let go a little, and let us do some of this together. Some of this is acknowledging what is not working. It's being in the present, and we're using different images. Different images, that's for, and the question is, what's yours? Okay. We're looking at also the gift and calls that are in the midst of conflict. And that our capacity to listen to God is only as great as our capacity to listen to each other when we're in conflict. Because conflict actually provides an arena for revelation. And here I close with the Emmaus story. Because I think it has something to offer to us. Ah, and the duck quacked for me. So this, I just want to offer you this image. And we'll close with this. That I think is community. And we could develop it further, but it's absolutely essential here. And I think it gives us a way to see anew what we've at times just stopped seeing. Now, we will hear from Mirinal's sister, Joanne Jeroko Doy, adjunct professor of intercultural studies and ministry, on befriending the poor inside and out.
Befriending the poor, inner and outer. I thank you for this invitation to participate in the conversations we must have in consecrated life today. When Maria and I first talked about the topic of the poor, or option for the poor, and religious life, I shared that I basically understand it as a given, that I can't really understand one without the other, that they went hand in hand. It is hard for me to make sense of religious life without an option for and with the poor. In many ways, it is what I have known in my own faith development, and I will share throughout this talk glimpses into my life experience that reflect this. However, I also find myself with questions that disturb, when at times the privileges in the negative sense outweigh this hand-in-hand understanding. The comfort level I live in now, the health care I have access to, the neighborhood, the three-story house, the two cars in the garage, the two computers in the basement, cable TV, the international travel, the graduate degrees I've received, the investments of the congregation that we live from. The hand-in-hand grip gets loose at times, and my faith begins to feel dry, like the drought in my home state in California. So I welcome this opportunity to listen anew to not only my call to religious life and mission, but to a shared call to discipleship. In light of Pope Francis's visit to the U.S., let me begin with Evangelii Gaudium, The Joy of the Gospel, where he quotes John Paul II in Santo Domingo, 1984. God shows the poor his first mercy. Pope Francis calls this divine preference. So it is not an option for us in the sense to opt in or not, but it is God's preferential option for the poor, the most vulnerable and on the margins, to which we are invited to participate. The invitation is also more than participating in God's mercy and loving kindness. It is an invitation to encounter the living Christ, to be called into friendship as Christ says to us, "I call you friends," from John's Gospel. Quote, "In their difficulties, they know the suffering Christ," continues Francis, "and we need to let ourselves be evangelized by them. We are called to find Christ in them, to lend our voice to their causes, but also to be their friends, to listen to them, to speak for them, and to embrace the mysterious wisdom which God wishes to share with us through them." Gustavo Gutierrez writes, "It is good to specify that the preferential option for the poor, if it aims at the promotion of justice, equally implies friendship with the poor and among the poor. Without friendship, there is neither authentic solidarity nor true sharing. In fact, it is a commitment to specific people." The document Aparecida says in this regard, "Only the closeness that makes us friends allows us to profoundly appreciate the values of the poor today, their legitimate desires, and their own way of living the faith. The option for the poor should lead us to friendship with the poor. To befriend and be befriended, we must all start again from Christ, recognizing that being Christian is the encounter with an event, a person, which gives life a new horizon and a decisive direction. How one understands poor, marginated, and vulnerable, and how one encounters the call of the living Christ is a matter of discernment in light of each congregation's charism. In my life as a Marinal sister, that encounter and Christ event has been most explicitly among the indigenous poor. It all began with a partially blind 6-year-old indigenous boy named Magdaleno from Tlamacasapa, a rural village on the outskirts of Cuernavaca, Mexico, who shared grace through both his vulnerability and strength and literally revealed the path for my life, the first steps towards my vocation as a Marinal sister. I was a participant at the Cuernavaca Center for Intercultural Dialogue on Development in the summer of 1980. Our group of campus ministers from the U.S. was accompanying Magdaleno and his mother back to their village after an eye checkup. In the city, Magdaleno had been very disoriented, withdrawn, and insecure. After arriving at our destination, where we could drive no further, we began to walk the final portion of the journey. As we began the challenging climb up the steep, rocky path to their home, Magdaleno took my hand and enthusiastically led the way as he deftly maneuvered the uneven path that he could barely see. Yet his feet intimately knew his tierra, land, earth home. It was our turn to be disoriented and insecure as the path slowed most of us down. Yet I felt carried along by his courageous radiance. Reflecting back on this moment, Magdaleno, in his suffering, tenacious spirit, and earth body wisdom, had revealed Christ to me and radiated God's love for the most vulnerable, and awakened my love for indigenous peoples, showing me the path for my life in Christ that would lead to Marino and the southern Andes of Peru with the Aymara people. The first time I set foot and eyes upon the Altiplano, high plains of Peru, I had expected a barren, wind-blown desert since the previous year had suffered the worst drought in over two decades, the effects of El Nino. At 12,000 feet above sea level, a normal year brings constant challenges to the narrow margins of the subsistence agriculture that sustains the Aymara people. Cycles of drought, flooding, frosts, hail, and insects are a constant threat to a good harvest. Previous to traveling from Lima, where I had been in language studies, our agronomist sister Aurelia Atencio had shared vivid stories of campesinos replacing their weak and underfed oxen by pulling the simple wooden yokes and plows themselves through the dry caked earth to create the furrows to receive the potato and grain seeds. How could anything hope to grow? I would soon learn that the Altiplano is a land of stark contrasts. The land transforms from the dry, barren, windswept plains of the winter months to a lush and verdant green carpet during the rainy months of the summer. The land respectfully coaxed into sharing her fruits by wisdom of centuries and relationship with the earth, the Pachamama. There are stark socioeconomic political contrasts as well, as indigenous peoples are marginated in their own land. However, faith in what was not yet, hope in the small stirrings of life, the size of a seed, enable life to enter the apparent barrenness. Only a month of new rains had turned the dusty landscape into a vivid palette of colors for the eyes, food for the body and hope, and body and soul, and hope for living. That same initial week, I also participated in a rito de perdón, a pardon ceremony, a regular practice in the campesino communities. Standing together in an open field, the new rains washed away the tears of forgiveness as members of the entire campesino community of Pilcuyo asked and received pardon from each other, renewing and reestablishing the right relationship among them that is so vital and integral for their living, for their very survival. In mission, we enter into the transformative process of crossing many kinds of boundaries. Geographic, psychological, social, cultural, and probably many other borders. Initially, one feels like a stranger in the wilderness, yet recognizes that the people and land are stamped with the very image of God and are mirrors that reflect the sacred, giving one a worldwide heart. And the stranger in the wilderness soon becomes friend. I had also expected a barrenness of tremendous difference as my greatest challenge in entering the world of the Aymara people. Yet I often experienced a resonance and sense of coming home that would move me to tears. It's the altitude, my Marino companions would lightheartedly say. My small stirrings of faith, the size of a seed, were received and embraced in friendship in their practice of hospitality. For me, the poor have names such as Pedro Copaja, Carmen Rosa Cayomamani, Victor y Jacob Barrientos, Candelaria Quispe Mamani. The Aymara people revealed the depth of spirit in their tenacious hope amidst suffering, sustained in their deep popular religiosity and practices of collective remembering. I experienced in Peru among the Aymara people what Johann Baptist Metz describes as a mysticism of open eyes and increased readiness to perceive, to see more, not less, to pay attention to visible and invisible suffering that leads to compassion and an expansion of love, being a witness to and participant in the cross and resurrection in our midst, the Christ encounter. This in turn would lead me back with new appreciation to the faith community I was raised in, the Japanese Catholic community in Los Angeles, and to reconnect to the collective memory of the Japanese American detention period of the generations of my parents and grandparents during World War II, the poor inside my own history that was unknown to me, to see the hidden face of God in my own history that illuminates an interreligious strength, wisdom, even joy amidst the hardship and suffering. I recall when I first shared my desire to enter the Marinal Sisters and this preferential option for the poor with my older sister. She simply replied, "I thought we were poor." It has been a gift and opportunity to befriend my own people and to discover many friends and allies of compassion along the way. My low-tech image, Christ of Marino. So Robert Lentz, the artist of this icon, reflects, "The icon does not make clear which side of the fence Christ is on. Is he imprisoned or are we? Through our cultural institutions and personal lives, we all place barriers between ourselves and true happiness. We in our institutions also try to imprison Christ in various ways, to tame him in the dangerous memories he would bring us of our goals and ideals. The Christ of Marino cannot be tamed." I sincerely hope this to be true. It is not without what we say in Peru, autocritica, or collective self-reflection and critique, that we are able to stay true. This globalized age is full of both life-giving benefits and not-so-life-giving seductions that impact the most vulnerable. It is inadequate to take our good intentions for granted. As Pope Francis writes in The Joy of the Gospel, "No one must say that they cannot be close to the poor because their own lifestyle demands more attention in other areas." This is an excuse commonly heard in academic, business, professional, and even ecclesial circles. The barbed wire fence in the icon carries special meaning for me as a Japanese American, a reminder of the detention experience of my parents and grandparents when they were isolated behind barbed wire in America's concentration camps. The more we love, the more we see. My eyes have been opened by love in Peru, which gave me new eyes and a new heart to perceive the suffering and hope from that time. The racialized experience of being Asian American in the United States often leaves us marginal, invisible, betwixt and between, dubbed the perpetual foreigner as well as the model minority, and even at times honorary whites. Reverend Deborah Lee writes, "Asian American theology for me has meant finding theological strength in rootlessness, transience, and itinerancy, and accepting the ambiguity and insecurity in the answers to the questions of, who are my people? Where is my land? It means giving up the relentless search for a home or a people and realizing that my people are all peoples, recognizing how itinerancy and fragmentation have something to do with the life and ministry of Jesus, and in fact, most people. It means living with ambiguity, uncertainty, and just the promise itself. It is letting go into love and finding ourselves home. The painfulness of our ambiguity is transformed into gift and challenge. With the privileges mentioned at the beginning of this talk, just which side of the fence am I on? Rather than endless debates about identity, which is constantly shifting, I am reminded that the important thing is to reach out across that barbed wire fence from whichever side you find yourself at any given moment. God constantly invites and asks, "Whom shall I send?" To reconnect to the suffering and hope of the detention period is to deepen compassion and perceive the ever-present plight still at work today in the U.S. amidst undocumented immigrants, Arab Muslims, imprisoned African Americans, and to reach out in friendship and solidarity. During a daily walk this summer at Marino, I found myself asking, are we still a gospel movement or simply a major employer of Ossining? Or more abruptly put, how do we get here to middle class? as I recalled many stories of the early days when it was a hand-to-mouth existence that did not limit our response to God's call to mission. Autocritica asks us to remember our roots as religious communities, to constantly turn societal privilege around. Puebla reminds us that, quote, the service of the poor is the privilege, though not exclusive, means for following Christ. Privilege in this positive sense, to be in mission among and with the Aymara people, has been the greatest privilege of my life so far. Hopefully, as a major employer of Ossining, we are making it possible for others to join in and discover the joy of the same privilege of participating in God's mission. At the risk of intercultural confusion, but trusting in the light, in conclusion, I would like to paraphrase from the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, number 55, that resonates with our constant call to the self-emptying practice of kenosis that echoes God's own kenosis through Jesus with us. 30 spokes converge on a single hub, but it is in the space where there is nothing that the usefulness of the cart lies, that makes the wagon move. Clay is molded to make a pot, but it is in the space where there is nothing that the usefulness of the clay pot lies, the emptiness inside that holds whatever we need. Cut out doors and windows to make a room, but it is in the spaces where there is nothing that the usefulness of the room lies, the inner space that makes it livable. Therefore, benefit may be derived from something, but it is in nothing that we find usefulness. May we be blessed with the grace of nothingness, emptiness that is filled with the fullness of God's mercy and loving kindness as we befriend the poor, inner and outer. Thank you.
Our final presentation is from Passionate Priest Father Robin Ryan, Associate Professor of Systematic Theology, who will speak on Living Paschal Mystery Amidst Changing Realities of Consecrated Life Today.
Good evening, everybody. My gratitude to Maria and Birgit and to all my colleagues here for their rich insights tonight. Well, I'm number five, so you're still breathing. Yogi Berra died this week. He famously said, "It ain't over till it's over," so we're almost there. My topic is Living Paschal Mystery Amidst the Changing Reality of Consecrated Life Today, and there's a handout with an outline of the talk on the yellow sheets. Back in April, I spoke about the experience of diminishment that's been so characteristic of much of religious life during the past 40 years or so, at least religious life in the so-called developed world. Diminishment in number of valid members and new vocations and properties and institutions and finances, and you know the story. And I raised the question of whether we've given sufficient attention to that experience that so many religious have been through. I wondered aloud whether enough time and space has been given to allow members to talk about the ways they've been affected by that diminishment. Those reflections were contextualized within the framework of the Paschal mystery, our shared belief in Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, and that mystery. I found the table conversation following my reflections very instructive. There were several younger members at our table, younger at least in their time of consecrated life. We won't give the real ages here. We'll protect the innocent. But they readily acknowledged that experience of diminishment that I'd mentioned. One member from another part of the world, however, commented that his experience was more one of growth and expansion. He comes from a country and a culture where the attraction to religious life is still strong. My table partners did agree that that experience of diminishment needs to be named and addressed in an open way. At the same time, they asked, how can we mourn the diminishment and still envision the future in a hopeful way? They wanted to know there's still life in spite of diminishment. They searched to find fragments of Easter in their living consecrated life in the everyday. During the summer, I reflected on two written works and on two experiences of ministry that I had with religious. The first source of my reading on the topic was the book by the well-known Marist whom Roger mentioned, Gerald Arbuckle, a book titled The Francis Factor and the People of God. Arbuckle, in his book, talks about, he reinforces really the need for religious congregations and the church as a whole to mourn the losses from the past. He resources his own background in cultural anthropology to offer an analysis of the post-Vatican II Catholic Church. I think his analysis is a bit overstated, but this is what he says. He thinks that the enthusiasm that marked the time of Vatican II was snuffed out by the Vatican bureaucracy and by an overall movement away from renewal and back toward restoration. He argues that the past 40 years or so in the church, up until the time of Pope Francis, have been marked by an overload of accumulated and unarticulated grief, in his words. Arbuckle claims that youthful energy for the mission of Christ has been suffocated. Using the tools of cultural anthropology, he analyzes all of this with regard to the church in general, but he also applies it to the experience of religious congregations and consecrated life in general. Arbuckle speaks of the need to let go of false attachments, to be open to God's will, a theme he thinks is pervasive throughout the scriptures. Such letting go involves loss, and the loss must be mourned if it's not to result in dysfunctional behavior. This is true of individuals and of cultures. As he puts it, unless this grief can be publicly articulated in mourning rituals, it will haunt the living and lead to dysfunctional behavior. Arbuckle contrasts what he calls youthful cultures with aging cultures. Youthful cultures encourage considerable flexibility, he says, because they maintain that energizing enthusiasm of their founding stories or myths. Tradition is respected, but it's not the sole factor in decision-making. There's a readiness to take on new ventures. Aging cultures, on the other hand, lose the flexibility of their founding story. They, in his words, obstruct adaptability or creativity in the face of changing conditions, and they tend to marginalize innovators. Using strong words, he argues that aging cultures fall victim to the comforting predictability of an orderly life, with its network of status, power, and prestige. Arbuckle contends that aging cultures are headed for extinction. As I said, his book strikes me as a little unnuanced and overgeneralizing in its assessment of the post-Vatican II church. But his insights about individuals and institutions needing to let go to mourn the losses in order to revitalize are worth thinking about. I think they relate directly to this theme of living paschal mystery amidst the changing reality of consecrated life. The second reading on this topic that I reflected on was the letter of Pope Francis to consecrated women and men from last November. I was particularly struck by two points that Francis makes in his discussion of the third aim of this year of consecrated life, the aim of embracing the future with hope. First, Francis directly acknowledges the experience of diminishment, even kind of delineating it to some degree, especially in the West. But he proceeds to assert that it's precisely amid these uncertainties, which we share with many of our contemporaries, that we're called to practice the virtue of hope. He goes on to observe that hope isn't based on statistics or accomplishments, but on trust in God. That's the hope that doesn't disappoint. And secondly, Francis speaks a word to younger members of consecrated life. He calls them the present and the future of this life, and he exhorts younger members to be actively engaged with the previous generation, what Maria was talking about a few minutes ago, to dialogue with older members in order that they, younger members, may be enriched by the wisdom of their elders, and in turn they will enrich the older members with their energy and enthusiasm. The first of my summer ministry experiences took place in Crossgar in Northern Ireland at the Passionist Retreat House of Tobor Muir, meaning Mary's Well in Gaelic. That retreat house is about a half hour south of Belfast, and it was scheduled for closure by the Passionists of Ireland about 3 years ago. But a small group of Passionists petitioned the Provincial Council to give it another try, with new kinds of programs. One of those programs is an annual ecumenical theology institute, which takes place in July around the time when the Loyalist marches begin, leading to the celebration of the Battle of the Boyne and the tension between Protestants and Catholics. It's always a time of tension, and this year, particularly in the streets of Belfast, it was right around our parish there, where a young woman was run over by a car. The Theology Institute, at which I gave a few talks, brings together Catholic, Anglican, Baptist, and Church of Ireland ministers and laypeople to reflect on issues of Christian faith. Older and younger passionists work together in running it. I found the experience to be intriguing in many ways. In a particular way, it struck me as a creative venture that reflected new life for the Irish province of my own congregation. I also led a retreat for a men's community in the eastern U.S. this summer. This congregation was especially hard hit by the effects of the sexual abuse crisis. It's still trying to recover financially and in terms of community morale. I was aware of this beforehand, and I wondered if I'd encounter a completely demoralized group of religious. But that wasn't the case. The provincial and some other leaders were there, as well as other religious, including a number of younger and middle-aged religious. I was impressed by the way in which they acknowledged their problems, the harm and the scandal involved, and their losses. They appear to be dealing with the crisis in a responsible and forthright way. And yet they still seem to find inspiration in their congregational charism, their life together, and their many diverse ministries. I had a long conversation with one member who just turned 90, who works every day as one of the intake people at a homeless shelter in a large city in the South. This community still appears to have life and to be generating life after enduring some death-dealing experiences. Recently, I met with three bright and thoughtful religious here at CTU who are younger members of their community, two of whom are here tonight. They will go unrecognized, protect the innocent here. Two women and one man. I asked them for their reflections on this theme of Paschal mystery amidst the changing realities of consecrated life. They were very honest about the experience of diminishment and its impact on both younger and older members. They spoke of encountering some older religious whose negative attitudes about life reflect that experience of diminishment and its effects. They talked about attending the funerals of older religious whom they've befriended. They realized that in the future, they will have fewer companions in their congregations, and they'll have to be creative in finding ways to form vibrant, supportive community life. But even with that realistic acknowledgement, I perceived a strong sense of hope in these religious, hope grounded in their deep conviction that God has called them to consecrated life. They have a profound sense of call, and they don't believe that God would call them to something that was dying. They're grateful for the opportunities for human and spiritual formation they've received. They envision this period in history as a time of great opportunity for younger religious. It's a time in which they're called to live their charism in an authentic way and to make a lasting impact on their communities and the church. These younger members spoke about the ways in which interaction with other younger religious at the national and international levels has inspired them. They believe that such opportunities should be expanded. They also articulated the need for younger religious to be permitted to explore new dimensions of mission. Such new ventures in mission will entail greater congregational cooperation at the international level, as well as more inter-community collaboration. In conclusion, in my reflections at our April gathering, I emphasized the experience of diminishment in consecrated life in recent years and the need for members to acknowledge and deal with the impact of that on their lives. My focus, I guess, was more on the suffering and death dimension of Paschal mystery. I found that to be confirmed in a rather strong way in the work of Arbuckle and also in my interaction with religious.
At the same time, I've also been struck by the fragments of Easter that are manifest in the lives of consecrated women and men, evinced in several recent experiences. The call to hope issued by Francis, a new venture at a retreat house in Northern Ireland, one aimed at reconciliation in a place of conflict, a religious community grappling with the harm done by the abuse of minors, but still convinced about its charism and mission, younger religious who treasure their vocations and believe in the charisms of their congregations, who envision new opportunities for life and ministry. In one of his works on Christology, Jesuit theologian Gerald O'Collins discusses the revelatory significance of Jesus' resurrection. He observes that the resurrection of the crucified Jesus led believers to a fresh understanding of God. The Easter experience disclosed to Jesus' followers that God can be found in the suffering one, even in one undergoing a shameful death by crucifixion. In O'Collins' words, "But with the resurrection, the disclosive power of the cross comes into play and shows that the weak, the despised, the suffering, those who become fools for God's sake, can serve as special mediators of revelation and salvation." O'Collins goes on to argue that the experience of the risen Christ suggests that the God of life that he proclaimed in his ministry is the God who brings life out of death. God is the resurrector. That is God's signature activity. It seems to me that O'Collins' observations about the revelatory significance of the resurrection can be applied to the Paschal mystery experience of consecrated life today. First of all, Easter shows us that God can be found in the suffering one, in those who are fools for God's sake. God's presence can indeed be found in and with many consecrated women and men who grapple with the experience of diminishment in their lives, perhaps at times feeling like fools for God's sake, yet who strive to live their charism. And secondly, our life as disciples is rooted in our belief in God as the resurrector. God is the one who creates new life and a new future in places where there has been diminishment and death. I've heard that bedrock conviction articulated with passion in the younger members of consecrated life whom I've encountered.
Well, it's time for you to talk. But first, let us thank our presenters, talking about the environment and interculturality, on the poor, on Paschal mystery, and community. So thank you very much.
This has been a presentation of Catholic Theological Union. For additional videos and podcasts, or to learn more, please visit www.ctu.edu or visit learn.ctu.edu.